A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk. Times Plus Live Comedy at Wilton's. This month's Times Plus Live Comedy at Wilton's brings you four not-to-be-missed acts at the beautiful Wilton's Music Hall in East London. Appearing will be Ed Axel, Nina Conti and Andy Zaltzman, all compared by resident MC Jared Christmas. It takes place on Thursday, 26th of January 2012 at 7:30 p.m. For tickets, call 0871 620 4025 or book online at timestickets.co.uk.
Welcome to the game. I'm Gab Marcotti, and this week we bring you the definitive review of the week's football. And not just that, we also have George Culkin, Stuart Robson, and skiving on his last week at work, it's Patrick Barkley. More of this later. Coming up, we'll be assessing Mark Hughes's first week at work, but we start in the Principality. That's right, Swansea and Arsenal. Now, we had a sense going into this, Stuart, that Swansea at home, they were tough. Arsenal, some issues, no Arteta. But did you expect such sort of five goals in this end-to-end, bad defending, good attacking?
No, I didn't expect Swansea to pass it quite as well as they did. I expect Arsenal to defend poorly in midfield, which they did. And it was too easy for Swansea to play. Swansea made the pitch very big. Arsenal were played through with such ease in midfield. The midfield players didn't worked hard enough. Ben Ayoum, who came in for Arteta, when he closed the ball down, it got played past him. He didn't recover. Ramsey, likewise. Song took 20 minutes to get it, almost his first touch. So I was really disappointed with the way Arsenal defended, but really pleased with the way that Swansea attacked. You know, the midfield players, they played around pressure, and when they needed to, they got the wide players into the game, and they were brilliant when they were running with the ball. It was a great example of how to play around pressure but also be penetrative with your play as well.
Paddy, we've praised Brendan Rodgers before, for me primarily because he bears a passing resemblance to our boss, Tony Evans. Mm-hmm. But this is pretty special. I mean, what they're doing, they've been doing it all season, and they've done it against perhaps more, you know, bigger, more physical teams, but also more technical teams who are used to having most of the possession, like Arsenal now.
I think Swansea are a very technical team, but I just endorse everything Stuart says. They just get better and better now that they're finding their feet, they're developing confidence. They're influenced by Barcelona. They're influenced. I read an interview on over the weekend with Rodgers when he said that his father had passed down a love of the great Dutch teams, Rinus Michels, you know, inheritance, and you can see that in the way, you know, Stuart talks about them playing around pressure, and you can see that they're not frightened to pass the ball around the back, to move, take two steps back, to take one forward. I mean, they just. they play in, I think Roger says, seven lines, which is so good. You know, we used to have three in English football, and now teams are playing in seven lines, and this can only be terrific for the game. I don't know, what more can you say about them? If they can keep their players at Swansea, I think they can be a serious threat to the top teams, because they seem to be losing their fear all the time, don't they? And if I was a footballer, I'd want to go there.
And I tell you what they did. Brendan Rodgers made a great tactical substitution at half time, because they had a lot of possession, but they weren't actually creating chances in that first half because there wasn't enough support for Danny Graham. Yes, they had wide players, but suddenly he took off Augustin and put Sigurdsson in behind the main striker. Yep. Although they didn't enjoy the same amount of possession, when they did get it, they looked more threatening. Yep. And you have to take your hats off to Brendan Rodgers again.
Yep. Just very briefly, though, I think the other thing you can say about this is that you should take your hats off to the whole club, because Roberto Martinez started this whole culture at Swansea City. So you couldn't just in case Chelsea are thinking, what if Boas goes wrong? You know, we'll get Brendan in, and within 10 minutes we'll be playing like Barcelona. It doesn't happen like that. Yeah, the whole club has to be pulling in the same direction.
That was actually the thing that I was going to say, that the really nice thing about Swansea is that there seems to be a kind of a culture of football at the club, and it's gone over successive managerial spells. So the players that come into the club know very quickly how they're supposed to play and get this sort of great grounding. But I was also going to say that I saw them draw 0-0 at Newcastle a few weeks ago, and you know, by no means was that a great game of football, but you know, Swansea aren't just this team that play beautiful flowing football. There is a steel about them. They haven't been surprised by coming into the Premier League, and they know, you know, they know the sort of the tricks of the trade to get valuable points away from home as well sometimes. So you know, they're very much a three-dimensional team.
Okay, so here's what gets me. Oh, and by the way, before we end that, I just want to point out Swansea, I believe, the only Premier League side where the supporters' trust sits on the board. And I think that's something, you know, even if you're a neutral, just for the fact that they do that and it seems to work,
it's another reason to support
them. But, George, what gets me about it, we talk about, you know, the way they play and then they add players who fit that. But, you know, I'm looking in central defense, you know, Ashley Williams and Stephen Caulker. Stephen Caulker's and I'm asking you, George, because Caulker sounds a lot like Culkin. In fact, it's just almost, you may even be related. This is a guy who comes from Tottenham. He's got, you know, I'm not suggesting Tottenham, you know, don't teach your people to play technical football, but you know, these two guys get dropped in there. Neither one is Beckenbauer, but they work and they fit in a more pass-oriented context.
Yeah, exactly. That there is this sort of ethos that you know, that they're buying into or asked to buy into, and that's kind of already in existence. And I just think that must help the club, that must help the team in some ways. I mean, you know, as I said before, that it's stretched back. It's not just, I mean, Brendan Rodgers has done an absolutely fantastic job, but this kind of philosophy has gone back kind of over a generation, if you like, of, you know, more than one manager. So that there's something there for people to sort of to get sort of rooted into very, very early, and I think that's kind of one of the nicest things about one of the things nice about the club. I'm waffling a bit here. Caulker, by the way, a caulker is somebody who puts tar on the inside of ships or barrels.
Mm. Oh, wow, and whereas a caulkin is what is?
Well, it must be related.
Right, okay. You never checked?
No. Well, caulkin, a caulker, I've checked that.
A caulkin is actually a small caulker. If you're a caulkin
who works on toy ships,
can,
right?
You can grow into a caulker.
Yeah, it's like an apprentice of some kind.
Well, I look forward to graduating.
All right, Stuart. That said, right? Mm. This is, I keep going back to this. We have managers talking about, I need money to get players, blah, blah, blah. Give me more money. Back the manager. And we know that we'll be hearing this soon because it's the giant transfer window. I look at this, and I really don't, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know if I want to be unkind to the Swansea players as individuals, because they, you know, many of them look good on the ball. But, you know, we live in a world where we've had a bunch of sort of players go for 8, 10 million last summer. Craig Gardner for 6.5 million. And I look at these guys and I ask myself, okay, which of the Swansea players are actually good and would go for something approaching 10 million? And you know, you could maybe make a case for the goalkeeper form. I think Joe Allen's a fantastic player. Scott Sinclair, he's fast and he's got the pedigree. Maybe he can go to the next level. A lot of people like Dyer. I personally think he's a bit too small. But that's kind of it. Like, these other guys, I mean, are these average players who are specialists who are made greater actually by the system and by the manager? Or, except for the guys I mentioned, is there anybody here who's actually very good?
I think the left back looks a good player, Taylor. I mean, he's good on the ball. He's a good 1v1 defender. But I'd go back to saying about Dyer. I watched Southampton's youth team play against Aston Villa's youth team many years ago. And in that Southampton youth team was Lallana, was Walcott, was Dyer. They had two centre-halves, I can't remember now, but both have played for, I think one went to Portsmouth and has played in the top flight and been somewhere else. Southampton, he might have played as well. And Aston Villa had Agbonlahor. They had Luke Moore, who was one of the subs yesterday, and a couple of other. Gardner, I think, was playing in the game. Now, the best player on the field, and you've just said it, you're not sure about his height and he might be too small. The best player on the field was Nathan Dyer. But because Agbonlahor ran in behind and scored two goals and he was bigger and faster than everybody else, and because Theo Walcott did exactly the same for Southampton and scored a couple of goals, all the scouts go away from that game saying Walcott and Agbonlahor, they're the players. The best two players on the park were Lallana and Nathan Dyer, who were technically much, much better. And that showed again yesterday. Nathan Dyer, Scott Sinclair were technically much superior to Theo Walcott.
Wait, let me ask you this flat out. You're Wenger right now. Would you swap Walcott for Dyer straight up?
If it was Arsene, I know Arsene Wenger wouldn't. I would, yeah.
Really?
Yes.
It strikes me there's a bunch of things to criticize on Arsenal. Paddy, Wenger accusing Nathan Dyer of diving and conning the referee. Is Dyer a big fat cheat?
I mean,
or is he a little quick cheat?
It was a little bit. I don't think it was. It was just instinct. That was nothing worth dwelling on. Also, I mean, Wenger's. I'd yield to no one in my love and admiration for Arsene Wenger and what he's brought to our game. I think he's a terrific bloke, and he's produced so much that's wonderful about our football. But he's talking a load of rubbish at the moment on a habitual basis. When he talks about scrapping the January transfer window, I do say here. I wish we would drop the January transfer window. When he talked about the television schedules being loaded against Arsenal, he sounded like Ferguson on a bad day.
Well, unfortunately, the Arsenal fans, many of them are seeing this now. They are saying after games, we don't want to hear all about the transfer window. We don't want to hear about the match code. We want to hear what's going wrong with your team, not whether, you know, the things that Arsene Wenger keeps talking about at the moment. He's papering over the cracks at the moment.
I think it's quite funny. So a lot of managers would agree about the transfer window, but they would probably say it's because, you know, they don't want to lose their good players, their best players, the pressure it puts on certain clubs. I think Arsene Wenger wants to scrap it so he doesn't get asked any more questions about why he's not spending any money.
Well, hey, one question, and I'd want to ask, and I appreciate that they have absences and injuries and whatever else, but when you have a situation, in football, you have a situation where they have a veteran player in Andrei Arshavin who makes a lot of money, and you know, you guys were criticizing Walcott, which fair enough. I'm sure Arshavin appreciates that because we're talking about him and not. Yeah. But Arshavin makes more money than Walcott. Now, his contract expires in June. He's obviously not part of Arsenal's long term future. I just find it interesting that Wenger plays him in this game. Is it a question of desperation? Does he think Arshavin can still help, that Arshavin still has some kind of pride? Well, because what I would do is just tell the guy, like, you know, here's the rest of your contract. Just give the rest of the money. Go away. Anybody will take you. Great. We save some money. But we're not going to extend you. You're not part of the future. you know, move on.
I don't think Arsene,
or is that mean to a footballer?
Yeah, I don't think Arsene Wenger will ever do that. He hopes the player goes on his own accord. That's what players have done before, Vieira and...
But if
and
you keep playing him, he might not go of his own accord. He's not
happy. Arshavin's not happy. There's no question about that. You know, he's not getting enough game time. But Arsene Wenger will defend him and say that the stats say that he's still creating a lot of opportunity for other players.
So if that's the case, why not give him a new contract if you really believe that?
But he doesn't believe that because he would have played... Jovino's ahead of him. Walcott's ahead of him. But he still puts him in place of Rosicki because Rosicki hasn't got the pace to go down the outside anymore. At some point, he's going to have to find somebody to replace him.
Enough Arsenal. Let's move to the great Northeast.
Yay.
This is getting kind of ridiculous. I know, like, sometimes you need to take a step back. But Newcastle are back in the top six again, largely because Liverpool can't beat anybody at home. This isn't supposed to happen. Demba Ba is gone. Cech Tiote wasn't there. I know, right? It's only a win over QPR, but I mean, Leon Best, Kabai has to come off. You know, Danny Guthrie, the former Bolton axeman. This guy Williamson at the back. Something's happening here, George, and. Is it time to anoint Pardew as a genius? Is this the luckiest team in the world? Is it God saying, you know, I actually feel sorry for Mike Ashley for all the abuse he's taken and for renaming the stadium the JJB Sports Arena? What is it?
Well, good question. You know, very good question. I mean, the one thing I would say is that if you look at the sort of narrative of Newcastle over the last year or so, compensating for players who leave or who are missing is something that they've done very well. Andy Carroll leaves a year ago. That caused a huge controversy. And the sort of the bit part players stood up and made a difference. You know, talking about Leon Best yesterday scoring a goal, but he scored 3 in 5 games this time last year. They lose, you know, really big players in terms of importance in the dressing room over the summer. Joey Barton, Kevin Nolan, Jose Enrique, and yet a new team kind of comes forward and steps into place there. And yeah, they've done the same this time. Tiote and Barr have been missing for the last two games. They've won the last two games against QPR and against Blackburn in the Cup, and the whole thing kind of motors on, which is really impressive. You know, yesterday's game was not great by any stretch of the imagination, but they kind of find a way to grind out a result. And when you think that you're talking about Newcastle in that sense, it's pretty remarkable. And certainly, yes, Alan Pardew, it is time that he got huge credit, because he's not only shown that he's got the sort of the character to sort of deal with what has always been a fairly testing managerial position. He's also, you know, he also knows how to set up a team. He was kind of relentless yesterday in the way that he kept shifting the midfield to compensate for Kabai's loss, but he did it, you know, did it really, really well. And you know, another 3 points and up to 6, equal with Arsenal on points after 21 games is astonishing, really.
Stuart, this flies in the face of logic. When they had a lot of good players and very good, very highly paid managers, Newcastle were kind of hit or miss. Now they have, I don't know when I say he's a bad manager, but he's, you know, he's Alan Pardew. He's not getting paid the bazillions. He replaced a popular guy who was also underpaid. What's the explanation here?
Well, George said something, and I don't think he meant it in the way that I'm going to say it. They got rid of some big characters in the dressing room. I think George was saying that was a problem for Newcastle. I think it's the best thing that happened to Newcastle, because big characters in the dressing room, if they're bad characters and they want too much say in the dressing room, that's disruptive for the
club. Names.
Well, obviously, Barton. I'm not sure about Enrique. Nolan and Carroll. They were a disruptive influence on Newcastle. They wanted to run the football club. They wanted to have their say whenever they wanted it. And there wasn't unity at the club. Now they've got a lot of players that want to do well. They're all working together. The manager's got control of the players. They're playing with good discipline. They're playing with organisation. They can change their game at times. We saw them play against Manchester United where they went route one. They won balls in the air. They can do that against QPR yesterday because they've got Leon Best and Amiobi up front, who are big players in the air. And that's what Alan Pardew's done. He plays the right game plan at the moment for depending on what opposition he's playing against and also the players he's got available to him.
George, you buying that with Barton and Nolan that disruptive and unpleasant? I mean, I can imagine Barton, but I mean, I don't know.
I think you know, you have to go back and look what happened when they were relegated, and without sort of going into sort of ancient history, what happened at that time was exactly what Newcastle needed. There was no leadership at the top of the club. Ashley was trying to sell. There was no permanent manager, and Houghton and that sort of that big senior group of players really took charge and took control and took control of their own destiny. And you know, that was a very, very important moment for Newcastle, and you can certainly argue that they wouldn't be in the position that they are now without that happening. Yes, there were huge divisions between the dressing room and the boardroom, and you know, kind of certainly my instinct was to sort of be supportive of the players in that dispute, but there is also no doubt that it stopped the club progressing. You know, as a sort of top club has to, it just, you know, it felt unsustainable, and you know, I was certainly concerned when those big characters left, because I worried that the players that came in wouldn't necessarily have the same affiliation, the same association with the club. But whether through luck or you know, sort of great timing, there's no doubt that Newcastle start the season so well. That momentum has allowed them to sort of to kick on, and that sort of spirit has been preserved in a way that's also allowed the group to be kind of more, you know, more manageable. So I certainly understand what Stuart's saying, and I kind of agree with it. You know, those players have been absolutely pivotal and fundamental in Newcastle getting back to the Premier League and then stabilising last year. And you know, it shouldn't be underplayed their importance to that story. But I think it's also fair to say that they've now moved beyond that too.
About QPR, I mean, we touched upon the new manager Sparky Hughes last week. He's come out and he says that he wants to win the title and he's ambitious, and I'm just wondering, obviously it's what an owner, I guess, wants to hear. Is that a clever thing to do? I mean, he didn't say with what club.
Yeah, and I hope he'd like to say, I hope, you know, like, because too many managers, so they keep reading Mark Hughes say, I want the club to match my ambition. So what he's saying is they've got to spend loads of money. You know, I'd like to see Mark Hughes, first of all, get it right on the coaching field and do more coaching, say, right, now I've got the balance of the team. Now I've improved the team by, you know, 50%. We're now halfway up the top. Now maybe back me and we'll buy one or two players to enhance that. But I think Mark Hughes, wherever he's been, has always wanted more money. And he's a much better manager, actually, when he's up against the wall and his teams are playing with grit and determination. Because when he was at Man City, his team were dull. They couldn't. I mean, Mancini has proved that you can still play or still make Man City with the players that they've got, a determined, rugged team, and also good on the ball. Mm. Mark Hughes wasn't able to do that.
It is true that he did better at Fulham when he wasn't spending a lot of money. But, Paddy, I do see, because obviously, let's face it, I mean, you know, when you get Mark Hughes, you get a team, you also get Mark Bowen, who is highly respected, from what I've heard. And you
Eddie,
also
Nedvicki, yeah.
Okay, yeah, he's got a high reputation.
Eddie Nedi, yeah, but you also get Kia. And if you, I mean, does it make sense to
Kia Jurabjian, the agent?
No, he's not an agent; he's an advisor.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
He's right. Most definitely not an agent. He is an advisor. Let's get that straight.
Good.
Thank you. So once you get, so you guys get a team. I mean, I was wondering, does it make sense to, I'm going to play devil's advocate for a minute here, but rather than bringing in a manager who coaches and whatever, and really doesn't know anybody in terms of agents, or maybe knows like the one agent who steers all the stuff through him and whatever. Does it make sense to think in terms of partnerships? So where I get Hughes and I get the guy who makes, who can make Hughes's deal, deals happen, whatever else you think of Kia, he knows everybody and he can make deals.
Look, it's a scandal. It should not be allowed. It's happening at Blackburn, but it's actually successful at Blackburn. I mean, Blackburn have actually bought rather well over the last 12 months. The manager is performing very, very well. But by and large, as a way of running football, it is absolutely scandalous.
You don't think managers should have agents, do you?
I think agents should be allowed
to represent both managers and players.
Correct. This is
which Keir doesn't do, by the way, because he's an advisor. He's not an agent.
I think that if Mark Hughes hiring Keir Jurabshin or anybody else
to advise
to advise them on their career and anything else is absolutely fine. But there should be no link, formal or otherwise, between an agent for players and an agent for recruitment, because that clearly, although Keir Jurabshin, you know, I'd make absolutely no claim against him, he seems a very nice chap, I met him, and but the potential for other less scrupulous people to create basically mini cartels at their clubs, so that the clubs, instead of recruiting what they need, recruit what the agent wants to get rid of.
That's the problem. Every football club these days.
In all over the world, and it's a scandal all over
the world. There used to be a system where you had a scouting system, and you said, this is our the way we want to play, this is our philosophy, this is our vision, we want somebody in that position that can do this. Our scouts will go around the world, now we'll get a whole load of players. Which one can we go and buy? Now pass it over to the chief executive. This is our number one target. This is our number two target. This is our number three target. Can you go and get those for us? But now it's the agent coming to the manager and saying, this player's available, this player's available. Or you go to the chief executive, they do the deal, and suddenly the manager's got a player he doesn't want. Mm. And there's always a conflict of interest.
It's quite simple that it should be against the laws of football, and it should be fundamentally policed, that no agent can be involved. It's very, very simple. Okay. No agent should be involved on behalf of a club in a transfer anywhere in the world to any degree. It is as simple as that.
Unless that agent doesn't represent players and is purely a middleman.
But in that case, there's no need for him.
Of course there is.
No, there isn't. This is exactly how it... The choice of whom to recruit should be up to the manager and the manager alone.
Yeah, the manager's first job in modern football... The manager's first job is to work with the players. You can't expect a manager to go and to know and to be able to run the scouts and to have a sense of what's going on over the world and have the relationships to get the deals done at the right price.
No. But the players can... And it should be the healthy thing is for each agent to approach the manager or the chief executive and to say, look, we have this selection of players, here are videos of them which don't include them tripping over the ball, would you like to buy them? They cost £20,000 a week. Now he then looks at those, goes to travel to watch those players play for Rennes or Sochaux or whoever it might be. He takes a look at them and says no thank you, and all he's lost is two EasyJet flights to France. If he buys those players simply because the club has a deal with them, gives them 5-year contract, that is not in the interest of the club. They've lost a lot more than two EasyJet flights. And the point is that this was how it used to be. It used to be a player could have an agent. Absolutely no problem with that. That's always been the case. But an agent was not allowed to work for a club. The regulations were changed, and it was a catastrophe. Most of us at the time brought it in and thought, that's fine, that's great. It just legitimizes what probably goes on anyway. But it has been an absolute catastrophe. And in the Premier League alone, it costs £75 million a year just to give money to largely unworthy intermediaries. And I've worked out that each person who goes through a Premier League turnstile is paying an extra £4 to £5 to pay for this unnecessary intermediary activity.
Actually, this merits a whole other debate,
I'll tell you the reason for it. Because agents claim, and claim to the FA, and I had this from the FA, that agents say that if we're only allowed to represent players, we won't get any money because they don't pay us, whereas the clubs do.
As you probably heard, it's a sad day for us at the Times, and especially here at the Game podcast. Paddy is leaving us after I think what, just over 3 years,
yep,
at the sports desk. I'm not going to make this a soppy tribute or anything, but obviously, Paddy has been around. It's been an inspiration for me personally, and I think for many of us. So I wish I could give you a big sending off. All I can do is I let you choose this week's debate topic, Paddy.
Yeah.
Because I know that what you like to do is to talk about football.
Those were super words, Gab, and I really do appreciate it. And working with people of the caliber of yourself and Mr. Robson, not to mention George and all the other writers, has been a pleasure, and I shall certainly miss the Game podcast very much indeed. Now, empowered by you, Gab, I will start a debate on goal line technology. Now, on the face of it, it's like motherhood and apple pie. Everybody except Sepp Blatter and Michel Platini want it. What can be wrong with technology that says whether or not the ball has crossed the line? Personally, I believe, and I'm a convert away from being like everybody else, an advocate of goal line technology, I'm profoundly against it, and I think it's the biggest threat to the character of football that I've ever come across in many more years than I'd care to remember as an observer of football.
So you're talking specifically of goal line. We're goal not talking line, video technology.
Goal line technology.
Goal line technology, video, which tells us if the ball has crossed the goal line.
Yes. And the reason for this, I am, however, a passionate advocate of video assistance for referees, which was last heard of being the medium through which the referee realised that Zinedine Zidane had butted Marco Materazzi and therefore had to be shown the red card. It was a couple of years after that that video assistance for referees, even latent, was banned. It was at the Confederations Cup in 2009. A decision took place. It was changed on the basis of the fourth official's advice to an English referee, Howard Webb. And when Blatter got to hear about it, he said, right, no more tellies anywhere near fourth officials. That's it. In other words, he had the choice of two directions in which to go, and he went in the wrong one. We now have the possibility that at the International Board meeting in March, that if one of these, I think, seven companies bidding for the contract for this goal line technology can prove that this stuff works, it will be licensed, and it could even be taking place on Premier League grounds next season. The problem with it is that it solves the least prevalent problem in the game, which is the issue of whether or not the goal has crossed the line. We can all remember the times when it happened. Roy Carroll and Pedro Mendes, Frank Lampard against Germany in the 2010 World Cup, and most people also go back to the 1966 World Cup final. However, other cases in those 40 odd years are hard to find.
Absolutely agree with you, Paddy.
There probably isn't even one every two seasons. I think there was one at Watford. All of them, moreover, except the Jeff Hurst one, could be solved in the blink of an eye by a telly in front of the fourth official, because otherwise how would we know that they were wrong, blatantly wrong? So why do we need bleeping devices which solve this one almost unheard of problem, but do nothing to solve the equally serious ones. And I'll give you the example on the same day as the Frank Lampard incident in Bloemfontein. In another part of South Africa, during the Mexico-Argentina game, an equally blatant miscarriage of justice took place in terms of an offside decision. And of course, the bleeping device, which would be much more expensive than giving every official a telly, would not have solved that. We would then have had an equal injustice in the sense that England would have got justice vis-a-vis Germany, but Mexico would not against Argentina, or the other way around, I can't remember. So, in other words, we're getting an expensive thing.
You keep saying it's expensive. Do you
it's
know
very
it's expensive?
Yes, £200,000 a go, and there are 20 clubs.
£200,000 a game.
For the installation, and no doubt there will be maintenance cost. It's one of those things that seems like a good idea. In actual fact, it's a disastrous idea because it will increase the perception of injustice.
George, I'm sitting here with two shaven-headed Luddites. You've got a healthy head of hair, like most honest men. Can you tell me why they're wrong, please?
No.
Oh, come on. What kind of a debate is it? Well, you're against goal line technology as well. Well, I'm the only three people on Earth.
I'm against everything. I mean, that's my default, that's my sort of default position. And
well,
I certainly haven't joined the kind of clamor for video technology. And I certainly agree. I was actually thinking I was going to be the kind of the only person sort of saying this. I mean, I think I'm probably on the wrong side of the argument, but you know, and would grudgingly accept it that if it's introduced and it becomes a success, we'll then say, okay, fair enough. But I kind of have a natural lack of trust for kind of any new rule that comes into football, basically, because I worry that you know, the further we go down the line, the more the game is tampered with, the further it goes away from the sort of, you know, the admittedly brash, quick, speedy, heart in the mouth, sort of seat of the pants sort of game that we grew up with and love, and it becomes yet more sort of sanitized, and delay becomes sort of part of the whole process. I kind of agree with I agree with Paddy. I think that sort of the one, when you introduce it in some format, it's then going to highlight the other areas where it's not
right,
and then we're constantly re-refereeing the game as it goes along.
All I'm suggesting, as a profound traditionalist myself, as I think all football lovers are, is that we restore the balance between referee and spectator. No more than that. I want to go back to the balance that existed before the invention of television.
And that's why commentators and co-commentators have to give their view on the first thing they see.
Exactly.
Not sort of say, let me just have a look at that on three angles and three... dived. You, as a co-commentator, you see it happen, and I say, if I was the referee, I'd have given a penalty. Then when you see the replay come back, you say, maybe he didn't touch him that much.
Under
but
my
you
proposal,
have to give the referee
the
credit.
The fourth official must make his decision solely on what the viewer sees.
So, in other words,
there's no special assistance, there's no stop in play, there is no appeal. This idea of give the managers two appeals each per half, we'd immediately hear, oh, we'd use the two up when the really big decision came along. You know, none of this nonsense. It would be only referees and their peers, because all fourth officials are on the same level of expertise as referees. It would be, in other words, the sanctity of the referee's decision making would be maintained. It's just that he'd have the same advantages as the spectator.
I think you make a very compelling argument. And what your argument basically does is it says reality isn't what happens on the pitch. Reality is
what's experienced by
the viewer. I don't think your system would right too many wrongs, because you do need, you do need different camera angles and things like that, and it removes the discretion.
It would right only the Pedro Mendes wrongs, the Frank Lampard wrongs, the blatant wrongs.
It does level. It does level. It does level the playing field. You will still get arguments. I mean, I think we'd have to come around to accept that there will still be plenty of mistakes and controversies.
Let me give you a good example, if I may, about why the game won't be slowed, because I totally understand George's concerns. We're all the same. Any football lover would feel the way George did explained. Was it about a year ago, Manchester United were playing at Wigan. And Rooney, challenged by James McCarthy, elbowed McCarthy. The referee, who I think was Clattenburg, and the linesman hadn't really seen. Mm. So the referee does the usual thing, backs over towards the linesman and says, "What the hell went on there?" And the linesman says, "I don't know." And they say, "How do we get out of this?" And they concoct a consensus about what probably happened and give a yellow when a red was due. The TV, there would have been no need for that, because the fourth official, instead of the linesman saying, "I don't know, mate," and the referee saying, "Well, come on, make us guess," the fourth official would simply say, "Rooney, elbow, red card." And that would actually have solved, and you would then not have the 60-second rigmarole of the two having a conversation about what may or may not have happened, and you would then have a 15-second delay before the referee gives the right decision, which is red card.
Well, what I find interesting about Paddy's proposal is that it completely redefines the game, redefines the reality of football based on what we experience via television, which I think would upset some purists. We can always throw up counter arguments to this, such as the fact that, you know, not every game gets the same amount of television coverage in terms of cameras there and angles and possibilities, and if you do give the same coverage to everybody, then you do raise the costs and things like offsides. You know, doesn't mean then players know there might be a replay, so they might just not play to the whistle and keep running and whatever. But I do think it's a good thing that we are talking about this, and you know, maybe we do need some lateral thinking. All right, time now for some quick hits. Manchester United roll to a 3-0 win over Bolton with Paul Scholes starting and scoring. Paddy, do you really think he's going to be enough for the club to enjoy their 20th title come May?
No. Well, I think Manchester City are going to win the title anyway. I'm still clinging to that belief. But no, I think if United do it, they'll do it with the youngsters. I think that Welbeck, who admittedly has a contract dispute, and Cleverley, who's a superb player, comes back into the midfield, I think that's going to make more of a difference than Paul Scholes.
On a more somber note, Dean Windass has revealed that he is one of those ex-footballers suffering from depression and, in fact, has twice attempted suicide. George, is it simply a case of footballers being people like us and therefore suffering like the rest of the population? Or is there something, in your opinion, having been around players, is there something endemic to the game which perhaps makes them more vulnerable?
I think it's both. I think it's absolutely both. I knew Dean when he was at Middlesbrough, and you know, he was the kind of person who absolutely lived for football. Who you know, everything was based around the game, and that included the socialising afterwards. There's no doubt that in football, as in every other walk of life, there are people vulnerable to, you know, to depression. But the one thing that has to be looked at is that football is still not good enough at preparing players for the end of their careers, and it's something that does need to be tackled. Footballers, particularly at the highest level, get everything put on a plate for them. I mean, they really, really do. And I just don't think that there's a coping mechanism. They're not kind of adults in many ways when their careers come to an end. And it's something that has to be looked at.
In fact, that matches my experience with footballers to a T. Spurs have nothing at all go their way against Wolves and are held to a draw. Stuart, we're told good fortune evens itself out over the course of a season, and there may have been situations when Spurs have been lucky to win earlier this year. But the fact remains, they sort of got screwed this past weekend. Any sympathy?
No sympathy. I think it will.
From an Arsenal man, what do you expect?
It will even itself out. But I still would say that Tottenham are playing the best football in the league at the moment. Their movement, their passing is brilliant. They're getting the balance right between defensive play and attacking play, just the same as Man City are. That's why Man City are the best team up until the last couple of weeks. And that's why Tottenham are the second best team in the league at the moment, because they get the balance right between the defensive play and the attacking play. And they're a joy to watch.
There you go. Stuart, all happiness and light this week.
Right, Gab, one for you. The Milan Derby was on Sunday night. Did Claudio Ranieri manage to reopen the hunt for the Serie A title?
Indeed, he did. Claudio Ranieri actually has a surprisingly good record in derbies in Italy. It's something like Italy and Spain. 9 wins, 1 draw, no defeats, including wins over Real Madrid when he was at Atletico. He went out there, very tactical game, conceded possession to AC Milan, who surprisingly started Pato up front alongside Ibrahimovic. Milito nicked the goal. And I think now it's very much game on, very tight at the top. You could see arguably as many as 5 clubs still very much in the title hunt, at least on paper. And what an incredible turnaround. In late September, this team was in the relegation zone. That's all we've got time for this week. Remember, you can always go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis, our web chats. Paddy, sadly, will no longer be doing one for The Times, but I will on Tuesdays. And you can experience the joys of Matt Hughes on a Monday and Ollie Kay later in the week as well. A bunch of us are on Twitter. Always a good way to hit us up and say hello or tell us we're wrong when you fancy that. That's all we got time for, and I'm prattling on because, as I mentioned before, and I won't get emotional because I'm a large man with tattoos, but it is sad that after 3 years working with what for my generation was I think a real role model, Paddy's moving on, but I am happy to say Paddy's not retiring, and I will continue to follow him with interest. Till next week, bye bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
ACAST powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
ACAST helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. ACAST.com.